In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
The conventions have concluded. The campaign is underway from SDPB. Today is Wednesday, August 28th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump have 68 days to convince voters to embrace their distinct visions for America. Meanwhile, absentee voting begins in South Dakota in less than a month. Political scientists Lisa Hegger and David Wiltsy join us with analysis of the conventions and a look ahead to the political frenzy. A new COVID vaccine has been approved. We'll bring you the update on options for fall vaccinations. That's coming later in the hour. Plus, South Dakotans gather to gaze at some of the darkest night skies in the region. We'll preview a star party. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It is almost that time of year. The season of sniffles and sneezes is coming right up, and that means it is also time to consider rolling up your sleeve for fall vaccinations. Your doctor may recommend flu, COVID, RSV vaccines this year, and we're going to learn about some of those options with Dr. David Basil. He is a pediatrician and vice president of clinical quality at Avera Health, and he's seated across the table from me now at SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Dr. Basil, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Good afternoon, and thank you, as always, for having me.
There is a new COVID vaccine, I am told. Tell me a little bit about what's new about it.
Right. So we're kind of entering the world, the new world of kind of steady state with COVID, where it's more like influenza, where, you know, every year influenza changes a little bit, has a little bit of genetic drift or shift to it. Mm-hmm. We're seeing the same sort of thing with COVID, where it changes enough every year that you need to get an updated vaccine to cover the latest circulating strains.
And this is the time of year. What is the timing of the vaccine?
So for COVID vaccine, we anticipate having it in here in the next couple of weeks. And so later on into September and October is the prime period, just like influenza, to get your updated vaccines, getting ready for that respiratory season.
So let's think back to when the COVID vaccines were rolled out, and some of us were getting Pfizer and some of us were getting Moderna, and we were asking questions about whether you can mix them or match them. Are both these companies still making vaccines? Do I care as a patient who made my vaccine?
Yeah, so in reality, both companies are still making them, and the differences between them are so small and they differ between patient and patient so much that, you know, I couldn't even tell you which vaccine I got which time. And so mixing and matching is totally fine.
Okay. So I don't need to go in and say I'm a, you know, I've had these before. Okay.
No.
What's the time frame between the last one? Because when we think of a flu shot, we do them every year. But many of us have gotten COVID vaccines throughout the year, and many people haven't for more than a year. So how are we thinking about how long these vaccines last in our bodies?
Right. So the new vaccines that are coming out here this fall are against new strains. And so they are different vaccines than what you would have had even if you got one this summer for some reason, or certainly earlier. These are against the latest circulating strains, you know, so that they adapt to the mutations and are going to be more effective. And so, you know, they last really a good 3 months is about kind of what you expect out of them. And so similarly, we get asked a question, well, what if I just got confirmed COVID, got sick here recently, how long maybe before I would want to get a vaccine? And it's, unless you're high risk and the stakes are really high, it's probably reasonable to wait a couple months after you get COVID to get your updated vaccine, because then you have a little bit of protection from actually having the illness, and then you can have the vaccine to prevent it from getting a second one later in the season, type of thing.
Okay. For parents, how young are kids getting COVID vaccines now?
Just like influenza, 6 months and older.
Okay. Now let's talk about influenza and the timing of those shots. And I was always a big spread out your shots person. I don't think I have any logical reason for that. I just like to spread out my shots. So should you spread out your shot? Should you get them all at the same time? How do you think about timing for some of your fall vaccinations?
So it's perfectly acceptable to get them at the same time.
Okay.
And so there's nothing wrong with spreading them out other than, you know, the convenience factor of, are you really going to remember to come back in and get that second shot later on? Or is it just get them over with at the same time? Like when I go in here in a few weeks, when we get them in, I'll probably just have one in one arm and one in the other arm myself. But, you know, if you're like, maybe I'll have a little bit less reactive component to it if I spread them out, and you're pretty sure you'll go ahead and do that, that would be fine as well.
All right. When do you get your flu shot?
That's the nice thing about this. With respiratory season, it's the same sort of schedule. You know,
okay,
sometime on into September, and October is the prime kind of time period to get it. We usually see our influenza starts peaking in kind of December and into January, February months. The influenza vaccines do a pretty good job for, you know, a good 5 months through there. But it takes, you know, a few weeks before, after you get the shot, before you start becoming protected to that. So you don't want to wait until you see a lot of it circulating in the community,
sure,
and then get the shot, because then you'll be several weeks delayed before you're really, truly protected. You want to get that vaccine before we start seeing a lot of it.
Yeah. RSV shots, who are those for?
Right. So RSV is interesting, and we probably talked about this last year. So most people historically, you know, last 15 years have thought of RSV as an infant and toddler disease that causes bronchiolitis or wheezing in those very young children. Most common cause of hospitalization of children, you know, during the winter months. But we've come to realize that, you know, in most normal adults, it just causes a common cold, but then as you age, it can become threatening again and can cause hospitalization or even more severe illness. And so the current recommendations for the adult RSV vaccination is that anybody age 60 to 75 with high-risk conditions, heart or lung disease, kidney disease, should get an RSV vaccine, and everyone 75 and older should get an RSV vaccine, because it really can hit that older generation, that nursing home crowd, really quite hard.
All right. We're giving information from a South Dakota physician. There's lots of misinformation out there. But I also want to say, ask you about the importance of having a relationship with a primary care physician or a pharmacist, or someone that you can come and ask your individual questions, because a lot of people who are listening are at high risk for something or have a chronic illness, and they might have an individual question. How important is that to you? What are you seeing about the nuances of making vaccination decisions in your family?
The amount of information and misinformation out there on whatever topic, as we all
sure
know, you know, in the so-called information age, is just incredible. And so finding those credible sources that, you know, spend a large part of their time sorting through that can help you separate out what's truth from fiction, can help personalize it to your individual medical situation, your lifestyle, your health. That is just so important, and having that trusted voice that can be a partner with you through that journey is just critical.
Other vaccinations that you think are worth, now that we're thinking about them and talking about them, maybe they're not fall vaccinations, but by the way, pay attention to this vaccine is out there that could be a game changer for you.
You know, compared to, you know, 20 years ago, we have so many more ways to protect ourselves than we used to. You know, for adults, especially aging adults, I say aging, I fall in the category, you know, of 50 plus, there's the shingles vaccine out there that can protect against the re-outbreak of what we know commonly as chickenpox as children. So the shingles vaccine is something that you always want to consider as you get a little bit older. Tetanus shot every 10 years is still important. And then if you've got higher risk conditions, things like pneumonia vaccines, you know, as you get older, there's just a lot of ways to protect you against things that I saw earlier in my career that were just catastrophic that we just don't see nearly as much because we can prevent them now.
Yeah. How about HPV vaccines for younger kids? Like how old should you be thinking about that vaccine for your child?
Yeah, so you talked about the importance of having a relationship with your physician, with your pediatrician, with your family physician. That's the same way as adult vaccinations have really evolved. The same thing has been true for childhood immunizations. In those preteen years when you can start getting the HPV vaccines to protect young women, you start getting thinking around college age, and you start thinking about meningitis vaccines to protect them before they go to the dorms or out into the workforce potentially. There's a lot of things available that probably weren't available when you were that age and time to think about.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about just keeping yourself healthy as the fall years come along. Some of the preventative hand washing, basic stuff. Should we carry masks if we're going on an airplane now? Have we moved past that? Help me understand, other than vaccinations, how to sort of build my medicine cabinet and prep myself for the season.
Probably my number one recommendation at this point would be the days of toughing through an illness and going to work or school are probably behind us. That's probably the number one thing we can do. And we all feel guilty about that. You know, I don't want to let my workers down by not showing up that day. But that's a lot better than giving them whatever bug you have, you know, going around. And so that's probably the number one thing I'd mention: staying home, testing for COVID and other things to make sure that you're not spreading stuff around. Number two, getting plenty of sleep. You know, eating right, staying healthy in general is going to help ward off all of this respiratory season.
Yeah. Kids are back in school or almost back in school, depending on where you live. And those germs are going to come home. So take care. Get your chicken soup ready.
Absolutely.
Dr. Basil, thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, as always.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. For today's Dakota Political Junkies, we're going to bring you a tale of two events. Both had similar decor, red, white, and blue color schemes with an abundance of stars and stripes. Both had South Dakotans proudly announcing which candidate could lay claim to our delegates' votes. But the overall tone and messages at the events were very different. The Republican National Convention was in Milwaukee from July 15th through the 18th, and the Democratic National Convention was in Chicago from August 19th to the 22nd. And now the race to Election Day. David Wiltsey and Lisa Hager are associate professors of political science at South Dakota State University, and they are seated in SDPB's Janine Basinger studio at SDSU as our Dakota Political Junkies for the day. Dr. Wiltsey, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. A little correction, I was promoted, so I'm professor.
Congratulations. Let's have a party now. Professor Wiltsey. Dr. Hager, welcome back as well.
Great to be here.
All right. The first time that I really understood what a convention was when I read Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail in 1972. I did not read this book in 1972, to be clear. But that was the first time that I got like an inside look at the insanity that a political convention can be. Lisa, start us out with what is this? Why do the parties gather together and wear some really outlandish, tacky clothes and start celebrating the future of America?
Well, obviously this process has evolved, but currently the whole idea is that this is an opportunity for the party to name their presidential candidate. Obviously, going into the conventions, we know who is going to be that candidate. So this is an opportunity for a lot of pomp and circumstance and celebration of the candidate, the party, and really this look toward that election. And then naturally what we end up seeing is a bump for each candidate after their convention.
All right. We're going to listen to a couple clips first. So people who didn't watch can hear a little bit of the moment when there is what's called the roll call and each state takes the microphone. Here is from the Republican National Convention with Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden has the mic.
Madam Secretary, I'm Larry Roden, Lieutenant Governor of the great state of South Dakota. I'm proud to speak on behalf of myself and Governor Noem and our delegation. We represent the freest state in a nation built on the principles of freedom. On behalf of South Dakota's, I wanted to say one thing. President Trump helped bring our fireworks back to our Mount Rushmore. That monument honors four of our greatest presidents. And I believe there's room for one more. Just saying. On behalf of South Dakota's 29 delegates, I proudly cast all our votes for President Donald J. Trump.
Audio from the Republican National Convention, and here is South Dakota's roll call from the Democratic National Convention.
How do you cast your vote? How mitake api, chante washten abe chuzapalo. In my beautiful Lakota language, that means hello, my relatives. I shake your hand with a happy heart. That is the spirit of my beloved South Dakota. My name is Chante Redis, and I want to say that my people, the Ocheti Shakoan, are still here. The seven council fires are still here. Let me tell you what a Kamala Harris presidency will mean for me, my friends, and my community. More importantly, more opportunities, more good-paying jobs, better access to healthcare, and a quality education. That is the future we deserve, and it is the future we will win on November 5th when we elect Kamala Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. The state of South Dakota is proud to be part of such a historic moment in our country's history. We are a land that is proud of our hardworking farmers and ranchers, that celebrates nine tribal nations and their incredible cultures, where natural beauty can be seen from the Big Sioux River to Mount Rushmore. South Dakota is honored to cast all 20 of our votes for Vice President Kamala Harris, who will soon be known as Madam President.
You heard there from the Republican National Convention, Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden, and from the Democratic National Convention, that was Shante Reddit and then Shane Merrill for the South Dakota Roll Call. Dave Wiltse, the fun, the excitement, the energy, and the opportunity of a roll call moment, it's obviously not necessarily for all of us, but it's for the room, for the House. What comes to mind for you there?
Well, it is, in a way, for all of us. What they're trying to do, and this has been true of conventions from the very first back in 1832, is package the party going into the general election. Even though the nomination doesn't take place there any longer, except on a very formal basis, they're trying to put together a package for the American people, try to reignite people's latent partisanship, get them thinking as Democrats again, get them thinking as Republicans again. And that's what all this pomp and circumstance, as Lisa, you know, noted, is all about. Getting people reengaged in the political system and getting them in that frame of mind going into the general election.
What stands out about how these conventions to you now were conducted? It seems almost like ancient history to remember that former President Donald Trump was coming off of surviving an assassination attempt, and there was a somber beginning to that convention. What else stands out to you?
Well, the somber tone of his own acceptance speech was pretty remarkable. He was, you know, he wasn't the Donald Trump we're used to, and you know what really stood out with the Democratic convention to me was, whereas the Republican convention was trying to get us back to essentially 2016, repackage Donald Trump, get him into the general election on a good standing, the Democratic convention was kind of a change of generations. We're not going to see a huge break, and we didn't see a huge break in terms of policies from, you know, Kamala Harris or from Joe Biden to Kamala Harris. But it really was a recurring theme of, here's the next generation of political leadership. And this is something that just folded very neatly into everything that the Democrats are trying to present right now in terms of that switch from Joe Biden stepping aside to Kamala Harris, you know, taking this nomination without, without the primary process, or without having gone through the primary process.
Yeah. Lisa, she doesn't have, Kamala Harris does not have much time, but yet that was a huge switch and it gave a bump to the Democrats in general. What are some of the challenges and opportunities of the timing with which she entered the race as a presidential candidate that's laid before her?
I think automatically she got a ton of news coverage because of the fact that she was entering so late, which then she can really use as a springboard through her campaign. And then with the DNC, that also gives her an additional boost, this chance to have more media coverage about her. So I think that helps put her on a more equal footing. The other thing that helps is obviously she's been the vice president, so it's not as if she's been out of the news or people aren't aware of her or anything like that. So I think in terms of there being much of a disadvantage, she's been able to really ensure that there isn't much of one. And the DNC did a good job of really trying to, you know, talk about this idea of we're moving forward with a sort of, you know, new generation. And then also kind of talk about all of the policies that they are interested in working on if she becomes president. And I think, you know, that sort of tone really helps set the stage to get people excited.
Yeah.
Virtually all the complaints that are being levied against Joe Biden in terms of his age, in terms of kind of this gerontocracy within the Democratic Party, instantly done away with.
Gerontocracy. That's a good word.
That's your $5 word of the day.
There's our word of the day. And it seemed like the Republicans, especially the candidate Trump, did not quite know how to pivot quickly to deal with her candidacy. Now they've had a little bit of time. The shine will wear off on the people who were excited about her at first as they look more closely at her policies and her history. What do the Republicans need to do next? What do you see them doing that you think might be an effective way to, you know, to get their message to the people?
Well, exactly what they are doing. And that really is, you know, speaking to the identities of the modal Republican out there. This is how Donald Trump has won elections in the past. And if he's going to pull this election off, he's really going to have to energize that that base of his party with the very essence of his being. I mean, that's how this guy has done so well. There's just something about him. He is able to speak to a very large portion of the Republican Party, really ignite their base identity in ways that others can't. And people who try just don't seem to do it. I don't know if it's the authenticity with which he speaks or the way he carries himself, but he energizes folks very clearly in an important way. And he is just going to keep on doing what he's always done. And that's probably his best path.
Lisa, what would you add to that?
I think the thing that Trump needs to do is focus on what Harris's record has been as vice president. I think focusing on that will be more beneficial, and using that to juxtapose his own performance in office and try to highlight his strengths versus her weaknesses, I think will be very helpful going in. And I think we'll see a lot of this being displayed when we do get to the debates. Not that those generally tend to really change people's opinions much if we look at the research on it, but I think that's where we'll start to see the strategy come through, and then we'll see an impact occurring when it does come time for some potential polls to come out.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about that because who's paying attention right now? Like, maybe no one yet. But yet, absentee voting, I should say, begins on September 20th in South Dakota. So there are people who will go and fill out their ballots as early as that. When do Americans start tuning in to the presidential race in a way that is significant if they're not party faithful, if they're not the base that, you know, tuned into their prospective convention every night and got excited?
The research on this is pretty clear. It's the conventions. The conventions really do kind of signal a shift in people's attention, and that's when they really begin to fall back on their latent partisanship. Most Americans do have latent partisanship, even though a lot identify as an independent. They really do have a deep-seated identity as a Democrat or a Republican. And that's when that latent partisanship is activated. So they know what they're doing here. And you look at their messaging, you look at the packaging, it's all about getting people excited again, getting people thinking about politics after a long summer.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about U.S. Senator John Thune, because he was in our offices and, of course, people widely, you know, talking about, I didn't invent this conversation, but I'm happy to be part of it, and that is the future of his leadership in the U.S. Senate as Mitch McConnell steps away. And I'm going to play a little clip here for you of that conversation where we just asked him, like, what is the behind the scenes of that? Do you campaign to become your party leader in the Senate? And here's what he had to say.
After every November election, every 2 years, the Congress, the House, and the Senate hold leadership elections. So Senator McConnell's announced he's not going to run for Republican leader. So that position will be vacant after this election. And I've indicated, announced that I am seeking that. There are others who are as well. And it's a full-time, it's a campaign. I mean, you've got to convince your, persuade your colleagues that you're the right person for the job. There are currently 49 Republican senators. We hope after this election there'll be a few more. If we get some new ones, they would be able to vote in that election as well. So it's trying to make a persuasive argument about, you know, why you're the right person to lead Republicans in the future. And, you know, transitions like this are pivot points. They're an opportunity to kind of usher in that next generation of leadership. And I hope I represent that. We'll find out come November.
Yeah. Why are you the right person to lead?
Well, I think that we're going to be facing some really tough issues and challenging times. And I think, you know, the ability to bring people together, stylistically, I've always believed that leadership is about making the people around you better and helping your team succeed. You know, clearly, no matter who wins, the majority will be a fairly close one, as it has been, which requires, not only ability to try and unify your side, but hopefully to reach out and get some Democrats as part of the coalition. You know, to do most things in the Senate takes some level of bipartisanship. And I think the Senate historically has been that check and balance in our democracy because of the supermajority requirement to get things done. It's designed to protect the rights of the minority. And I feel like I've got the, you know, sort of the hopefully Midwest common sense character qualities that would enable us to govern under what are some arguably difficult circumstances and some hard challenges. We're going to have to do some hard things, and it's going to require an ability to try and, you know, pull people together.
Couple themes there. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. That was U.S. Senator John Thune, a clip from our interview with him a few days back. And my guests now, David Wiltsey and Lisa Hager, both political scientists from South Dakota State University, as we're giving a little analysis about the national picture here and how South Dakota fits into it. I heard him say next generation of leadership. I just heard Dr. Wiltsey say the next generation at the DNC was a big deal. I also heard him talk about Midwestern common sense, and that reminds me of the vice presidential conversations we've been having with these Midwesterners from Ohio and Minnesota in the vice presidential slots. And then I also heard, you know, governing and getting things done and working together and building coalitions, which is very different from some of the divisive speech that we hear again and again. Lisa Hager, what stood out in that list of in that menu? What would you like to select for us to talk for us to talk about here?
I mean, we could really talk about any of them. Mm. I think the biggest thing that I saw as interesting was Senator Thune's discussion of the need to really bring people together and work on essentially bipartisan solutions to a variety of issues. And I found that interesting just because, as we've seen, there's quite a few Republicans who are often unwilling to want to reach across the aisle. And so I think it is an interesting talking point to hear and to basically look at moving forward to really see how that pans out and what ends up happening. Like, also just with the election in general, you know, are the Republicans going to eventually be more willing to reach across the aisle? Because right now there's a chunk of the party that is very unwilling to do that and criticize members of their own party if they do that.
Mm. Dave, what would you add to that?
Well, he mentioned, you know, a new generation. But, in many respects, he represents an older style of politics. You know, like Lisa said, there's, you know, this new generation of politicos, people like J.D. Vance, who are completely uninterested in governance and more about, you know, just the inflammatory rhetoric, you know, what do we call it on Facebook, you know, something posting. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that's a style now. And that's something that people are very successful at. And John Thune is not one of those kinds. He's certainly younger than Mitch McConnell, so mm-hmm. it's, you know, generationally, yes, in terms of age, but he does represent a different kind of politics, and I would say, yeah, it is more sensible. I wouldn't describe that just to the Midwest, but he really is, you know, the caucus leader when it comes to that side of the party. Yeah. And, you know, this is a decision that's going to be made amongst the caucus. Like you said, a constituency of a few dozen is a lot different than a constituency of a few million. But yeah, it is a campaign, and we are going to, you know, see a tension between that more serious legislative type over the more rhetorical bomb throwing type. And who knows how that's going to end.
You mentioned Facebook there, and I've been researching abortion and the history of abortion politics in South Dakota for the coverage about Amendment G coming up that we're doing. And it occurred to me that it's too soon to tell what exactly we're going to hear and see in the public space. But some of, when you look back, the things people were willing to say about their abortion opinions, I have a hard time imagining people saying them today, because of the potential threats or backlash or what they might face on social media. Democrats come out of the gun. Lisa Hager, you're talking about reproductive rights. You know, it's all over in Kamala Harris's campaign ads that this is important. The Republicans come out and say, hey, they're radical with their abortion opinions. How much do you think the politics of abortion is going to play out in this election? And does it matter? Is it pivotal to this election, or is it just one of, you know, a dozen topics that are going to get people fired up?
I think it's just one of a variety of topics that are going to get people excited about this election. I think the biggest overarching issue at the moment is the economy. And I think there's going to be a lot of people making decisions based on their pocketbooks, but not only what is their general overall vision for public policy in this country moving forward. Is that something along the lines of what Donald Trump is proposing, or is that more about what Kamala Harris has on her agenda? And I think those two things together is what's going to be dictating this. Obviously, abortion's in there, but I don't necessarily anticipate people going to the polls based on their abortion views.
Hmm. Do you agree with that, Dave?
I'd push back on it a little bit. I think it is more salient now for Democrats than it has been in any previous election cycle. You've also seen a change in the rhetoric and the things that they're and that people are saying. We would never have seen the kinds of stories, you know, publicly that people are telling now in previous years. In previous election cycles, Democrats didn't even want to use the term abortion. Whereas now, people are more free about it in certain places. And as far as, you know, abortion being on the ballot in South Dakota and a few other states, probably won't make a bit of difference in South Dakota in terms of, you know, the outcome of elections around us. But I can see if you were to have this simultaneous election with a abortion question on the ballot in a swing state, that could make a difference. It might not be the most salient issue for a plurality of people, but it is important for a lot of Democrats out there. And it could be one of those things that helps push them towards the polls.
Yeah. Lisa, you mentioned pocketbooks. And I'm thinking also of Kamala Harris's ad that came out early, and it was something like, one job should pay the bills. The idea that part of the American dream should be you only have to work one job. And I thought, what's the economic policy to make it so you only have to work one job? Like, that seems very vague to me. But yet it also seemed bumper sticker worthy. in some ways. What did you think of that way she is addressing voters to say, in my America, you only need to work one job to pay the bills?
Well, that's the perfect way to get your point across without actually having to show how the rubber's going to meet the road with respect to that. So you can get people to vote for you and then later on really struggle to actually find a way to write that into policy. And yeah, you might have some of your supporters be disillusioned by you. There's always presidential support decay that takes place as the president gets into office and can't actually meet some of their campaign promises. But that's not really what she's worried about right now. Right now, she wants to get into office. So I think, you know, that's really what she's focusing on. And, you know, for somebody who's just kind of listening and that sounds good, then, you know, that persuades them.
Yeah. All right.
Or could persuade them.
Could persuade
them.
Yeah. In our final minutes, other things to look for as we kick off the campaign in earnest, where, you know, as we head into the debates, as people start, those flyers start coming to your mailbox. Maybe 30 seconds for each of you. Dave Wiltsy?
Well, I really am paying attention to, you know, how Donald Trump is going to try to revive that electoral coalition that got him there in the first place. And I honestly think he is going to fall back onto old habits, and because that is the path to a success. And as for Kamala Harris, what I'm really looking at is how she's able to cobble together the resources to, you know, get this election going on such a short timetable, and how fluidly she'll be able to take some of those party resources and put them behind her.
Mm. Lisa Hager, final thoughts.
I think with Trump, we should be looking to see how exactly he navigates the rest of the campaign. Like Dave said, if he falls back on old habits and becomes more inflammatory, I think that would possibly be hurtful to him and his campaign. As far as the Harris campaign, I think there might be some need for more substance and for an ability to defend her record as vice president in some of these areas where she struggled to have an impact, like immigration, going into debates and more substantive conversations about policy.
Yeah. Is it just me, or is J.D. Vance having a hard time connecting with people?
It is not just you.
Okay. No. What is the significance of that? It does seem like he, you know, the people who've read his book have something to say to me about who he is as a person, but the more I see of him trying to just be a real person in public, it seems like he's stumbling a bit. What's happening there?
Well, as I said before on this show, Donald Trump does not pick his vice presidential candidates in the way that previous nominees have.
Sure.
And that is biting him right now.
Yeah. All right. We're going to leave it there. We're going to have, obviously, lots more time to talk about this in the future. Professor David Wiltsy, a professor of political science at SDSU, and Professor Lisa Hager, associate professor of political science, also at South Dakota State University. Dakota Political Junkies, by the way, is also a podcast. So if you just want to binge on our political coverage, you can go to your favorite podcasting platform and just listen to these segments. We'll pull them out for you so they're all set up for your ears. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.
Definitely.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. If you are excited for clear skies this Labor Day weekend, I can almost guarantee that your excitement doesn't compare to that of our next guest. Hank Fradel is a member of the Black Hills Astronomical Society. He has already had to reschedule his organization's annual star party once due to cloudy weather, but the forecast, it is looking good this weekend. You can find him at Custer State Park with a fleet of astronomy aficionados and a few telescopes on Friday. But first, he's with us on Zoom. Hank, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori. It's great to be here.
This is one of the best places in the world to see the night sky. Tell us a little bit about the star party.
Yeah, you know, in western South Dakota, we're blessed with a number of spots which are pretty dark at night. But you get around Rapid City, or you get around Custer, or Spearfish, or any of the towns, you know, the lights just really kind of make things hard to see. And so anyway, we're working with Custer State Park this year, as we did last year, to host a star party. And it's going to be on Friday night at the 30th, It's going to be dark, probably shortly after 9, but I'd suggest you show up before then because people will be down there talking up things and there's going to be a video and whatnot. And the moon doesn't rise really until after about 2:30, and it's only about 11% moon. And so we've got a full night of great skies for us. All right. The other thing we've got going on for us is that this summer has just not been very good for night sky viewing, because not only because of the clouds and the rain that we've had, but also because of the smoke we've gotten from the western fires. But it's clear here, scheduled for Friday, and we're ready for it.
All right. How do you prepare? What do you wear? What do you bring?
Well, I'm going to be wearing a jacket. I don't know. It seems like in South Dakota, you know, it gets to be dark here in the hills and it's going to get cold. Or bring a blanket. I'd suggest bring a chair, too, because you can kind of, you know, you lay back in your chair and check out the Milky Way and what's going on. I'd bring some binoculars as well. But our Black Hills Astronomical Society members are going to be bringing their telescopes out. And we've got people that also can talk about the constellations that you can see. Some things you can see with your eyes, some things you can see with your binoculars, some things just take telescopes. And so we're going to have the full range of stuff going on. It's going to be happening down at the Bison Center on the Wildlife Loop. If you're not familiar with the state park, what you want to do is get in there by the game lodge. Campground in the visitor center. There's a road that heads south called the Wildlife Loop. You head down that about 20 minutes, and there's a turnoff then for the Bison Center. It's about a mile in. The great thing about it is that with the state park, they're going to be leaving the Bison Center open, which means we've got real toilets. And they're also going to be keeping their gift shop open here pretty late. And they are going to have the visitor center open all night. And so we are ready.
Nice.
If folks are thinking about they want to go camping there, I think there's still spots that are available if you want to bring your tent or your trailer down. And I think the lodges are open as well.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the society and some of the people who have discovered the night sky and can't get enough of it.
Black Hills Astronomical Society has been around for, I think it's 68 years now. And in fact, this month is kind of an anniversary for us, because 60 years ago, we started construction on our observatory that's out by St. Martin's Academy. And we're just a group that gets together, and we have meetings in the wintertime that deal with business. But during the entire year, we get together once a month, usually down at Culver's in the West End and Rapid City, and it's kind of a social thing, and we share information about what people are doing with their telescopes or what they've been doing on a night sky viewing. Right now we have, I think, over 60 members, and since the pandemic, our membership has been, you know, been steadily going up. It's amazing the number of people we've got now with some real deep skills with telescopes and with astrophotography. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
One of the things that's been made that's exciting about the club is that we're just given a couple of hundred copies of the 2024 Night Sky Almanac. It's 128 pages of glossy stuff, great pictures. It has, for each month, it's got two charts of the stars that you can look at. And it's got information about the planets and galaxies and all that stuff. They say it's a 2024 almanac, but I tell you, the night sky really doesn't change year to year a whole lot, other than with eclipses and comets and that kind of thing. So this is a book that, if you want to go outside and understand what you're looking at, it's a great little resource. And we've got those to give away to anybody that shows up at the Bison Center. So
nice.
That's kind of a fun thing.
What is a good entry point for a telescope, or, you know, to come and learn from other people? But is there an entry level way to think about this that doesn't break the bank, but that also doesn't disappoint you because you're not really getting anything spectacular out of your purchase?
I know exactly what you're talking about. About 6 years ago, my wife got me one of the tabletop telescopes that your parents get you at Christmas time, you know, when you're about 12 years old. And of course, I ignored it. And until I realized I could put my cell phone up to the eyepiece and take pictures of the moon. And I don't know what it was, but that just got me hooked. I wouldn't really recommend those kind of telescopes, though. They're they don't let you see much. The other mistake that people make is that they buy large telescopes that are not easy to carry around, and they're difficult to operate unless you've got people available to help you do that. And that's one of the roles that our Astronomical Society does is people will show up at our regular star parties and they'll bring their telescopes, and as our people are available, we can help talk them through how to do this. The other thing that's going on is the technology is rapidly changing. I just picked up a traveling kind of a telescope. It's fits in a box about 12 inches by 12 inches and has a little stand for it. And I'm able to go out. In fact, I was out last night doing astrophotography with this thing, and it pretty much runs itself. It's pretty easy to do. And for those who are nervous about it, you know, our club is the group that can help them get through that. I would really suggest if somebody lives in the Rapid City area to maybe show up at one of our star meetings, either there at Culver's or, you know, you can find out when we're meeting through our website at sdbhas.org, and it tells you about our meetings, and just start asking questions. If all of a sudden you decide to buy, you know, the 10-inch telescope and you're just wondering what to do with this thing because they're not easy to set up and get going, I'd suggest you talk to somebody first.
Yeah. In our remaining minute, what are you looking for? What do you enjoy when you stare at the night sky?
You know, I was up I was up this morning about 3:30, and I was looking at the moon, which is now just a little crescent, and it was right next to Jupiter and Mars. And I don't know, just seeing those kind of conjunctions of things that happen, it's pretty thrilling for me. I also I have an observatory at home too, and I was looking at the some nebula. It was the Veil Nebula I was looking at, and taking pictures of it. I like all this stuff because it really gets me to think about the scale of the universe and how big this place is. It's just amazing to me. You know, 90% of what we're going to see down at the Bison Center, 99% of what we're going to see down at the Bison Center is really within our own galaxy, the Milky Way. And the Milky Way is just going to be on display down there. You know, it just stretches from the southeast to the northwest, and it's, or northwest to, okay, it's going to be stretching up there.
Yeah.
And it's, I get my head mixed up.
To the end. Yeah. I'm going to actually jump in. I got to jump in, Hank, because I do want to let people know before we run up on our time is that they can find out about the Black Hills Astronomical Society and Custer Tate Park's Star Party on our website, sdpb.org. We'll put it up there, or you can find them on Facebook. But the gathering is Friday, August 30th. Meet at the Bison Center in the park at 8 p.m. local time. Hank Fradale, thank you so much. It is always a delight to talk to you. We will definitely check in with you about what's in the sky again in the future.
All right. Take care, Lori.
You too. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the program, fascinating creatures. We are going to hear about chameleons and bighorn sheep and more on Tomorrow's in the Moment from all of us here at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.